Honesty is never easy, but honesty is necessary. It is not meant to be easy. Change is never easy, but change is necessary. And we get there not through force, not through chastising ourselves or criticizing ourselves, blaming ourselves for making mistakes, but forgiving ourselves for making those mistakes and being curious in discovering more mistakes. You know, self-awareness is a journey not in being right, but it's truly a journey in discovering the millions of ways in which you've been wrong.
My name is Fauna Asfa, and after doing the backbreaking work to save and reclaim my own life, my passion now is to help others do the same. Since writing my debut book, Sober Daughter, the amount of people that wanted more inspired me to create this podcast. This space is for both real people and industry professionals to share inspiring experiences and usable tools for us all to connect and heal ourselves together. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the power of self-awareness with Amit Pagadar. And remember to stay tuned to the end for some powerful tools to take with you. Today's guest is Amit Pagadar and the author of Finding Awareness, The Journey of Self-Discovery, who's been writing on Instagram since 2018 under the name Finding Awareness, creating a community of self-discovery. His writings explore the path of ego conditioning, self-awareness, and meditation. He works to empower people to take their own journey into the nature of their minds and discover the source of their power, authenticity, and freedom. And I am so happy to have you here. Welcome, Amit. How are you?
Thanks, Fauna, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm so happy to talk to you and see you.
I know. I've been following you and sharing your work for, I don't know, a couple of years or more. And I fell in love with how honest it is and how extremely introspective, you know, it is. And I know that for me, my self-discovery journey started and I really needed a kind of like warts and all approach to self-discovery, like the ugly stuff, the dark shadow stuff. Mm-hmm. And your work is, it just provokes that. And it's so in depth. So I'm so grateful that you're here. And I want to know, I have so many questions. First of all, what led you down this path to, you know, looking at self-discovery and self-awareness and cause you to start writing? Because I know you've been writing and writing and writing.
I started this work back in 2010 or so, and I was going through a really bad ending of a relationship. I had assumed that a person is something, and then you realize that the person is whatever you made them out to be, and the reality can be totally different. So when you have that, when you have this crisis in identity, you begin to question everything about you're in the world, you begin to question everything, whether do you even understand reality the way it is? Yeah. And that's when I started truly questioning. I mean, I was meditating and all from an early age, right from the age of 15, but it is only over the last 14 years, I would say, when I began to really look at what attachment is. How do I find security in another person and start depending on that person to provide that security and become really attached to that person? And when that person tries to free themselves, just be who they are, it causes me pain, it causes me suffering, causes me anger, causes me grief. So that is the path I started on, understanding myself after undergoing a separation. In the same time, I lost my job. I was an immigrant in the United States. And as an immigrant, I put in a lot of money for education, started a job over here. But once I got laid off, I lost everything. The education, the money, the savings, everything was gone. And I had to go back to India. So started from scratch. Yeah. And then I had a health crisis also. Simultaneous health crisis was going on. Ended up in the hospital, lost 12, 13 pounds of weight, quite clearly weakened the immune system, quite clearly weakened physical body, physical self. And so a real re-evaluation, a real rediscovery had to be done about who I am, what do I want for myself, who do I see myself as? And that's how the journey began. Not that it got any easier after that, because then followed other problems. Life goes on. There are other issues, addictions, this and that. But then I worked through them, as we always do. And into 2018, I started sharing my thoughts on Instagram and trying to keep them as clear, as precise, as logical, as rational as possible. And through the process, a whole different journey began to write a new book and so on and so forth. And here I am.
So much happens, you know, when we lose that outer shell of the attachment of what we think we are or what we think we have. And that huge identity crisis is just, it causes so much healing, but pain. It can be really, really painful.
It's
And
always.
always so painful. And I love that you talk about it because I don't think people talk about the, you know, loss of identity or the identity crisis and change and grieving that goes on with all of that.
You know, suffering really forces us to look within. Now, if we weren't suffering, if life was a vacation, we had all the things that we needed, materials-wise, material wealth, relationship, everything was fine. Health was fine. People were there in our lives. We had the money, we had the job, we had everything. We would never look within. We would just be on a sort of autopilot, just cruising through life. But as it happens, most people are hurt on the planet. Everybody is hurt in some way or the other. And they are passing on their hurt to others through their own pain. And as such, we eventually come across something or somebody or some event happens in our life, which causes sorrow, suffering, grief. And when that happens, that's when we begin to question. I believed this was a way to live because everything was fine, but now everything is not fine.
Yeah.
And this is for the fortunate among us. The unfortunate among us, unfortunately, have traumatic childhoods, have parents who are not present, have things which have happened to us, whether it's physical abuse, sexual abuse, mental abuse, emotional abuse in childhood, which we had absolutely no control over. Then it's the growing through that and becoming deeply traumatized, insecure in your adulthood, and then beginning to realize my actions are a certain way because of my past,
yeah.
And then reevaluating your past from that standpoint. So there are many different stories going around us, but every story has an element of suffering, and every story begins with suffering. So quite true.
Absolutely. And so many people have different starting levels, right? Like you talked about, you know, if that you have that deep childhood trauma, or, you know, you've got the sexual abuse and things like that, we're starting at a different point. And I love that you share that because there's so many healing communities or conversations that think, you know, promote this idea that everyone starts at the same place.
No, they don't.
We literally do not. And that's part of being honest, right? In our self-discovery is that some are more privileged than others, and they're going to have maybe an easier path going to, you know,
absolutely.
Vulnerability. If I'm not safe, it's going to be entirely different for me to practice vulnerability than it is for somebody who's, you know, been supported and surrounded.
Yes. If I have the social structure around me, if I have the family structure around me, if I have my friends around me, it is far easier to heal in that environment. But when I'm doing work by myself, I'm looking for a community for myself. I'm looking for a helping hand. Not always is it available. Some people cannot. We say, oh, yes, you should have a therapist. But you know what? Some people cannot even afford a therapist.
Yeah.
Now, what should they do? If they can't afford a therapist, what do you do? Okay, then read books. Okay, well, I'm doing two jobs and three jobs. I don't have time to read books. Then what do you do? And this is the environment we live in, because so many people are going through. I was reading a statistic the other day, like 30% of the US adults, just this is US, have experienced anxiety or have anxiety disorder. And that's a completely wrong number, in my view. 30% know that they have anxiety.
Right.
You know, the real number of how many people might have anxiety would be in the 80s, very high, 75, 80%, somewhere in that range. Because some of us do not have even the time to fix ourselves. We are so busy trying to just survive. And a lot of people, whether it's they're listening to your podcast or consuming other self-help material, they're doing it on their way to work. They're doing it while driving. They're doing it on the train. They're doing it while they are working. In the one ear, a podcast is playing, in the other, I'm taking orders, you know, I'm serving customers. So that's the world we live in. And that's what we have to embrace and say, you know, there is hope for everybody. There is assistance for everyone. And there are people who are doing it the right way. You just have to find them and see what they have to say, see if it applies to you, and go from there.
Absolutely. And how did you get into this space of self-awareness for others? So if someone is new listening to you now, they are at work, they've got their kids, they're doing all the things. What is self-awareness in your own way of explaining that to us?
To put it very simply, when I am suffering in my life, whether it's my relationship not going well, whether it's incessant worry I have about the future of my children, whether it's me not being able to hold a job or me not being able to work in my job because my boss is screaming at me or traumatizing me in some way. He's being rude to me. Whatever issues we have in our life, the first question we ask ourselves is, what is the underlying fear that I'm feeling? Because a lot of people, a lot of us go through phases of anger. We say, this person is responsible for my pain. That person is responsible for my pain. Yes, they are. But the responsibility of coming out of that pain is only yours. Nobody is coming to save. Nobody is coming to help you. This is a brutal, tragic truth of our society at the moment, that only you have your back. Nobody else has your back. So if you have your back, you've got to start watching the way you have been thinking.
Yes.
If I'm having trouble in my relationship, is it because my husband or my wife is really a bad person? Do they really have ill intentions for me? Or am I having too many expectations from them? Just a question. And suddenly I realize, oh, maybe I am. Maybe they are just the way they are. And I'm having expectations from them. Then you ask the next question. Why is it that I have so many expectations? Why can't I just let them be? Then another answer arrives and it says, oh, well, because nobody has ever been nice to you. Nobody has ever loved you. Nobody has ever said a nice thing to you, said they appreciate you. Nobody has ever given you their complete, total acceptance, validation. And that's why I'm looking for it from my partner. Why did that happen? And you keep asking these questions, very simple questions. We are not using any fancy language. We are not doing anything new here, but we are just looking at our own minds. And step by step by step, the lights begin to turn on. And we see, oh, there's a pattern in my childhood. Oh, maybe my mother was always busy. Maybe my father was too engrossed in his work and they did not pay attention to me. Maybe they compared me too much with my older brother. Maybe they compared me too much with what other kids were doing in our culture, because sometimes it's cultural, sometimes it's religious. And I was forced to conform. I was forced to be like somebody else. They never saw who I actually was. They always ignored my feelings. They didn't intend to, but it seems like it just kind of happened that way. Then we say, okay, should I blame my parents? No. Then you ask the next question. Why did my parents do this to me?
Yeah.
And then you realize it's their own conditioning, their own past, and on and on and on it goes back in generations. So we realize we have nobody to blame, but we have everybody and everything to understand. And as I start moving through this process of self-understanding, my mind begins to calm down because now I say, oh, I understand why I'm afraid of this thing. I understand why I have certain desires, why I have certain motivations. Then I say, okay, what are the motives underneath my motives? What do I really want? Do I really find this person attractive? Or are they resembling my parents in some way? Are they fulfilling a void I feel within me left behind by incomplete upbringing? Mm-hmm. And suddenly, oh, no, I can't go after this person because I need certain non-negotiables. I need to understand myself. I need to know what I actually want in a partner, not just go with somebody because they like me, because they want to be with me. And so my relationship awareness expands. My parental upbringing, conditioning awareness expands. Then there is awareness in other areas. As all of this expands, I begin to really understand myself, who I am, why I am the way I am. Then as things begin to fall in place, other things arise. What do I really love to do? Why am I doing this job, which I don't like? What is my real passion? What is truly calling to me? What makes me forget myself, lose sense of self, lose track of time? And then a true passion is born. A true drift is born. I call them drifts.
What is the drift?
A drift is something that is flowing through you, even without you trying to do it. A direction in which you find yourself moving, even when you're not trying to move in that direction. Imagine a raft on a river, and the raft is going along with the river smoothly. Nobody's paddling, nobody's doing anything, but the raft is going along with the water because there's a current underneath. The current is taking the raft. So what is a current within you? And we realize some of the things which we love doing, they just kind of happen. Like, I'm good at conversation. I connect with people.
Yeah.
Nobody else is able to connect with people, but I'm right there. I'm instantly able to connect with people. So that's a drift. I have a communication drift. And so I ask myself, how can I explore more of that? How can I learn more of that? Some people are good at music. Some people are good at acting. Some people are good at organizing, leading. Some are good at science. Some are good at something else. So we have all these skills, artistic and otherwise, within us, which we need to bring out, explore, build. Mm-hmm. And once we build them, explore them, that's where the meaning of our life comes from. Mm-hmm. That's where true self-worth begins to come from. because now I am giving meaning to my own life.
Mm-hmm.
See? And so self-awareness really begins all of this. It begins to fix your relationships. It begins to fix your trauma. It begins to heal you from your trauma. It begins to also tell you what you should be doing with the time that you have on this planet.
Yeah.
So that is, in a nutshell, what self-awareness is. Just know yourself as you are.
To thine own self be true. And it's
mm-hmm.
getting, oh, I love, love, love when you talk about, I mean, when you talked about the drift, I immediately went to the time you were talking about people pleasing.
Mm-hmm.
And people pleasing, and are these labels that we put on ourselves, these boxes that we put ourselves in, when really this is all a practice of learning and unlearning this conditioning, these old programmings, these old stories, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
I love to say, for me, you know, fear is such a delusion. And it's such an imaginative, powerful, creative story. And I am imaginative and creative on my own. So my fear stories can be outrageous. And
Yes.
it presents as truth, right? But what you're talking about with us is that practice of self-awareness helps me and other people start to realize, oh, that fear, that story can actually be dissolved. It can actually be, you know, walked through, and now we get to learn, what was that fear trying to tell me? What am I needing? What am I wanting? What am I not looking at? And you said that with people pleasing, for the drift, that if we stop with these labels and we just start to realize that maybe I am a naturally helpful, kind
Yes.
person. And that leads me into a space where I do give a lot of myself, but I also find joy in that.
Yes, exactly. The reason why we have to figure out who we are is because that shows us in a very clear way, what is it that appeals to us?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it is things that we love doing. Sometimes it is our true nature, and our true nature is quite kind. Some people are very giving, very compassionate. Just their true nature is that. There is no people pleasing there. But because we live in a society which is now moving more and more towards labels, I label myself as a people pleaser and I stop seeing the underlying factors. Sometimes maybe I am people pleasing. And maybe the reason why I'm doing it is because I really want to be accepted. I really want to belong to a community. I really want my people to see who I actually am. And so I'm always trying to please them. Maybe I was traumatized in some way, which creates a fawning response, which we call. The fawning response is basically me trying to be very nice to everybody so that they don't say something which is prickly. They don't say anything which hurts me in any way. So I'm being very nice to someone. But then there is a third possibility that maybe I am actually a very nice person. I do enjoy doing things for people. I do favors to everybody. And the way to differentiate is to really ask yourself, am I doing this for others? And if they don't return the favor, if they are not nice to me in return, does that annoy me a little bit?
Yeah.
Does it displease me? Does that make me angry? Oh, I gave this to her and she never responded back, or she never reciprocated in any way. And that makes me a little bit angry, a little bit afraid that this is going to keep happening. Then I move away from that person. So that means I was trying to please them in order to get something back. But if I do something and then I forget about it, if I give a gift to somebody and I don't keep track of how much it costed, or I don't really wait for somebody to call me and I just call my friends because I love my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that means I'm a giving person. And it's okay to be a giving person because that's your true nature and you must flow with your true nature.
Brilliant to break it down. Especially, you know, we have so much telling us that we've got to fix, 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 fix all these things. And also the self-awareness is like, what's true to your heart? What's true to you? And we talk a lot in the recovery world and in, you know, our spaces, especially if people are sober, we talk a lot about anger and resentments.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's a key indicator to see if I'm angry at someone or if I'm resentful at someone, then that's a clear indicator that I either have expectations of them, I have opinions and judgments of them, I have now, you know, strings attached to my behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can get to a place where we're comfortable just saying, oh, I was a little bit resentful. I did expect something in return, and that wasn't true kindness. That was, me trying to manipulate the situation a little bit. It gets us closer to being honest. And honesty is not easy for a lot of people to do.
Honesty is never easy, but honesty is necessary. It is not meant to be easy. Change is never easy, but change is necessary. And we get there not through force, not through chastising ourselves or criticizing ourselves, blaming ourselves for making mistakes, but forgiving ourselves for making those mistakes and being curious in discovering more mistakes. Self-awareness is a journey not in being right, but it's a truly a journey in discovering the millions of ways in which you've been wrong and being happy
Love
and being
that.
happy about it. Oh yes, I did make a mistake there. Oh yes, I did mess up that relationship, and that's okay. I'm learning about myself and picking up these gems of insights, picking up insights about yourself and carrying on with your life makes us realize that once I truly understand my mistake, once I truly understand why I did a certain thing, I really don't have to do anything to change my behavior. The behavior change happens on its own. When I realize I expect too much from people and then people feel constrained around me or they feel restricted around me because I'm so demanding of them. Once I truly see that, not just intellectually, because intellectual understanding is one thing, but emotionally have something shift inside me after seeing the ways in which I'm putting pressure on people, there's no way I can put pressure on people again. The next time I meet somebody new or make a new friend, I'm like, okay, you can call me if you want, but if not, that's okay. I'll call you when I have time. And suddenly there is an ease in our relationships. One of the criticisms of self-awareness is there are no clear instructions. There is no do this, do that. But one of the benefits of it is all you have to do is keep looking, keep observing, keep listening. And the changes that you desire will just happen. You don't have to do anything different. The changes just keep happening.
I love that, especially that it's not a checklist to sign off, right? Like it's not this one size fits all. I mean, it's our journey into our own spirit. It can't be quantified. It can't do that, but we can help each other go through the process. And you shared too a little bit about, the definitions and the innate separation that can happen between us and others, especially you talk a lot about, partnerships and romance, like romantic relationships and love, and how much we can, separate ourselves, and the ego can really come into play there. And so I wanted everybody to know a little bit more about ego and the suffering that the ego can create through this delusion that we are separate and that there's something that I need to be right, wrong, or, above, below, all these things. And I know it was so, I just got so much from it. So if you can share that with people too.
Sure. Now, what is really the ego? If I ask myself that question, I realize through the process of self-awareness and careful examination that the ego is an outcome of three different processes. We'll talk about them. One is identification, which is me and my house, me and my husband, my wife, me just possessing people, possessing objects, me and my car, me and my religion, me and my culture, me and my country, me and my this or me and my that, my ideas, my opinions. And there is a central factor, the me thought, something that feels like there is something there, an identifying center in the middle, and all the objects that surround that center, objects that belong to that center. The interesting thing is, once we have these objects, there is an identification with the object. That's the first phenomenon of the ego, which is if I'm identified with my car and somebody puts a ding on my car, they open the door and put a hole in the side or put a dent in the side, or a hole. It hurts me. Oh, it's a new car. How could you do that? See? So when I'm identified with a car, somebody can bring a sledgehammer and beat the car. It's an object, but beat that object up and it's going to hurt me because it's hurting me. I am identified with the object. But am I really the object? Am I truly the car? Am I truly my house? Am I truly my religion? Am I truly anything? I'm not. I'm not these things. I have chosen to see myself through them. And now this creates a problem. If I've chosen to see myself through a myriad of different things, then I must keep protecting all of these things. And what a mess that makes of our lives. I must protect my identity. I'm a CEO of a corporation, or I'm a director, or I'm a this, or I'm an artist. Now I'm identified with being an artist. And if you call my art something, it hurts me. See? I am identified with being an American. I'm identified with being an Indian, or what have you. And if you say something about my country, it hurts me because I have put myself in that name, in that label. I've identified myself with a certain idea, and you attack the idea, it attacks me. I have created this. I didn't have to do this, but I have done this to myself. So that's the work of the ego. So ego firstly thrives on identification. Second, it thrives on attachment, which is the identification is fueled by attachment. And the underlying phenomena behind underneath the identification is my car gives me security. That's attachment. I love my car. I love its color. I love sitting in it. I love the way it smells. I love the way it drives fast. I love how I feel when people look at me when I'm sitting in the driver's seat. I love when people look at my car and say, "Oh, this is an expensive car you're driving. How clean you keep it. How nice you have it." And replace car with anything else, and it's the exact same thing. With culture, is the same thing. Or how wise people in your culture are, or how these people in culture are, how much wisdom you have. Same thing. Religion is the same thing. So once people is the same thing. I love the way my wife makes me look. I love the way she listens to me. I love the way she cooks for me. Or I love the way she says nice things to me. I love the way she understands me. And she understands my problems. She understands my troubles. And now I'm becoming attached to this person because just by the virtue of existing, this person or an object is providing me a great deal of security.
Which
And
is
I invite everybody to just look around,
yeah.
look around you, and you will see this as a fundamental part of your life.
It's like, what is that person giving us? What am I getting from that relationship, that attachment?
Exactly. Exactly. What am I getting from them? And so everything becomes a transaction. I do this for you so that you keep giving me that sense of security. You see? And if you don't do this for me, I get angry at you. So there's expectations, fear, anger in the relationship. All this is the work of the ego. All of this. Then there is a third phenomena. So we're looking at three phenomena. First is the identification, seeing oneself through other things. The second is the attachment. And the third is control. Because without controlling, I cannot have the first two. I cannot maintain my attachment. I cannot maintain my identification. So I must exert control. And what this does is it creates a tremendous amount of fear. I want to change people such that they suit me. I want to change the way society is. And so if I see somebody in society which goes against my principles, religious principles, or this or that, I want to change that person. Or you should not have these. I have a problem with your sexual orientation. I have a problem with your religion. I have a problem with your country. I have a problem with this. I have a problem with all these things only when I, in myself, I'm identified with something. See, if I was not identified with one, then I would have no problem with the other. Control really amplifies the divisions human beings have with each other. That's why human beings are so divided. We do not have this in any other species of animals. The lions are not divided against each other. The lion, I mean, they have pride, but they are not going to war for no reason. They only go to war when somebody tries to take their resources, which is a natural response. But human beings, as a species, we are just entirely divided among themselves, divided in our minds. So the ego is the basic deep fragmentation between me, the central feeling of me, and all these objects that surround me. That central fragmentation is what we see everywhere in society. So because man is divided from within, society of man is divided from without.
I love that. It's just the ego is almost, it's like a cognitive distortion almost. It's that this delusion that, we are not all here, one species in this, reality. And it causes so much suffering. It causes so much pain, and it causes so much of just, these control tactics. And so many people now get to see it played out, in politics, or, this divide and conquer. It's been used forever since
Forever, yeah.
we've been here. It's been used. And the more, people like you and people that share about what ego is, and that it's not, good or bad, it just is. It's just this innate division that creates this attachment. But then that attachment, that control piece, is what I think so many people don't know where that control piece came from, right? They'll just
Yeah,
go to that suffering part and not have any idea where it came from.
And this control piece, eventually it fails. Because there is no such thing as absolute control. You can never have that. We cannot control ourselves totally. There are always fears and desires arising. So when the control piece of the ego begins to fail, we start finding suffering. We realize, oh, I can't control this person.
Yeah.
I've tried to subconsciously, I've tried to control them, but I really can't. And one day we discover it when that person says, I want to leave you, or when that person says, I just can't do this anymore, or we have a big fight. We realize, oh my goodness, control isn't working. And we don't consciously word it this way. Nobody says to themselves, my control isn't working. But that's the realization that we come to, that I am not able to find certainty in my life. My life is very uncertain because the ego is trying to control so many things and discovering that nothing can be controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the ego asks the first question, which is why? And now the ego itself begins the process of self-awareness. We have a different notion going on in the healing community that ego has to be dissolved. The ego doesn't have to be dissolved because the ego is doing all the work. Everything that we are doing is, right now, whoever is speaking is the ego.
Yeah.
And who is listening is also the ego. But the ego is becoming self-aware. And as the ego is becoming self-aware, it is undoing itself slowly,
right,
step by step by step,
yeah,
until it reaches the last point where that doesn't mean we lose our name. That doesn't mean I forget who I am.
Mm-hmm.
That only means that the ego now becomes an organizer, not the owner of my life. Imagine a librarian.
I love that, the organizer. I love that.
I'll give you an analogy. This is a very interesting analogy to understand and observe. Imagine you walk into like a library, which is a state-owned, you know, beautiful municipal library. You go in there and the librarian says, I own all these books. You would laugh at the librarian. You would say, what do you mean you own all these books? You work here, but you don't own anything. You are simply an organizer. You give out books when people come and you take them back when people give them back. That's it. You don't own the million books here. But the ego says, I own my memories.
Mm-hmm.
Ego says, I own everything in here. I own my car. I own this person. I own my religion. I own my culture. I own my people. I own this, that. I own everything. And once the ego realizes it owns nothing, it doesn't dissolve, but it goes back to its original purpose, which is to be an organizer. So the ego will say, okay, you want to recollect a memory from childhood? I'll give you that memory. Go and fetch that book and give it to you. This is your memory. It says you want to put it back? I'll put it back. It says, okay, you want to go to work? You want to set up a meeting? I'll set up a meeting. You want to pursue a certain drift? I will help you pursue a certain drift. But ego is here to help you as a helper. Ego is your helper. Ego is not your boss anymore. He's not running things anymore. He's not the owner of things anymore. It's just an organizer. Mm-hmm. Just as you go into a library and say, I need a book, and the librarian walks with you. The librarian says, okay, I'll walk with you. It's on the fourth floor. It's all the way in the back. It's in this, and I'll come help you. And the librarian walks with you gently, slowly, assists you. He's very kind. He's very gentle. That's what ego is supposed to be.
Yes.
It is only an organizer. The librarian does not go to war.
No.
A librarian is not going to go to war over books. But if the librarian feels I own these books, then it can fight over the books, which is what human beings do. Human beings believe they own everything, which is what fight each other. But there's nothing to fight about.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing to fight about. You don't own anything. Nobody else owns anything either.
No. No.
No.
Can't own humans, can't own land, can't own, you just, it's here. It's innately here. We can't own, but that's such a freeing concept. And it's also terrifying for so many people, especially in the West, you know, that have been conditioned that ownership is the end all be all, right? And that our, you know, this country was built on the concept of ownership, owning people, owning cultures, just taking. And so when we look at the ego, like, we're really doing generational work here. Like, we're really repairing this deep invested sense in ownership. And I just think once, you know, you give such a safe place to explore that, you know, on the other side is such freedom, such healing from the delusion of control, because there's never control. But
it's never control. And you can own things. You can own you can own a car, you can own a house, you can own some land maybe. But if you're identified with it, this is mine, then I can't share it with you. See?
Yeah.
Then I can't make you, I can't ever accept that you have an equal right as me to share something with me. Just as I share this land, you have an equal right to be on this land. You have equal right to breathe this air. You have an equal right to be here. I can't accept that if I feel like I own everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we have to have a balance there, which recognizes the practical needs of society, the practical needs of what social structure is. Just because you can't identify with something doesn't mean I get to take what's actually yours. Doesn't mean I can just knock on somebody's door, pack, you know, take my bags in and go and live in somebody's house. I can't do that either, because that's not practical. But I have to understand that the nature of identification and the nature of not just social and monetary ownership, not just having something on my own, on my name, but the deep sense of ownership, the psychological sense of ownership, that's what we are really addressing. Because that psychological sense of identification and ownership is what creates division between people, is what creates hatred between people, is what makes one person superior to another person.
Yeah.
It was what makes one gender superior to another gender.
Mm-hmm.
See, we're not superior or inferior to anybody.
No.
We're not. And if anybody feels that, they're going to find out it that's not what reality bears out. Eventually, you run into conflicts. Eventually, you run into fights with other people, pain in relationships, and just deep, deep unhappiness.
Yeah.
And why do we want unhappiness? We only get one life, everyone. So let's be happy. And the way to be, way for collective happiness is personal peace, not collective peace.
Mm-hmm.
The way to collective happiness is my peace. I find peace. And when I find peace, everybody around me feels that, okay, this person has found peace. Maybe I can find peace too.
Yeah.
And then they find peace. And then that's how it spreads. Just the way hate and division spreads, that's the way love also spreads.
So powerful. And you are such an example of that. You truly are. Through all that you give so much of yourself in your writing. And it is an example that, I mean, I got so much from you, and I know that other people are too. And I'm just so grateful that you were here with us today. I think we have learned so much. And if you wanted to give somebody one thing that you would want them to try, just to start out on this self-awareness practice, what would you have them do?
I would have them try meditation, simply put, very easy.
Okay.
And the simplest way to practice meditation is the most organic way to meditate. What do I mean by that? Which means there are a million techniques.
Mm.
And people will bore you to death with 100 different techniques they give. Okay, I'm going to give you another one. But I hope the technique that I talk about is not really a technique, but it's something of a discovery, which is if you examine your mind, eventually you will come to the same place as what this technique is. And I actually, in the book, Finding Awareness, I walk the reader through discovering this meditation technique, which is just a logical way of thinking, and how just even thinking about yourself clearly brings you to a meditation method. As organically, meditation is happening through us. It wants to happen through us, if we allow it.
Mm-hmm.
So the technique is quite simple, and there's an acronym which you can use to remember it. The acronym is simply BLIS, B-L-I-S, with one S, and you can add another S in the end if you want. But the first B stands for breathing.
Mm-hmm.
I check, how am I breathing?
Mm-hmm.
My breath is a bridge between my mind and my body. If my breath is going haywire, it's haphazard, that means the connection is broken.
Mm-hmm.
That means it is communicating something to me. For example, I breathe very shallow when I'm anxious.
Yeah.
And I'm sad. I breathe very shallow. So our breath is a reflection of our state of mind. So if I correct my breath, I indirectly actually change the state of my mind.
Yeah.
The simplest way to breathe is taking 5-second inhales and 6-second exhales, roughly. It varies from person to person between 4 and 7 seconds, but usually it's between 5-second inhales and 6-second exhales. And when you start doing this, what will happen is you can feel this after doing 20 breaths. Focus your mind only on breathing. Don't focus on anything else. If a thought arises, go back to breath number one.
Okay.
And 20 breaths this way. Complete focus on breathing. If you want to talk to yourself, talk to yourself about, hey, this is in breath. This is out breath. This is the mm-hmm. breath coming in. This is the breath going out. So you're also talking about just breathing mentally.
Yeah.
That way you stay focused on the breathing. When you breathe this way, at some point, your heart rate will become stable. So your heart rate will be whatever it is, 70 or 65 for most people. And your breathing rate is stable. So you're breathing at the same speed, at some speed, and your heart is beating at some speed.
Mm-hmm.
When both stabilize, that's called resonance frequency breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a state of breathing in which your emotional states become clear, which is the mind cannot hold any emotions. So if you're going through deep traumatic feelings or sadness or anger or fear, you do the resonance frequency breathing, which is 5 second inhale, 6 second exhale, and wait for your mind to clear. You will find that it's like clearing off a table, like everything on the, all the clutter is gone and the mind becomes very clean. So that's just the B.
That's
just the B. Then there is the L. The L is listening, which is not listening to the mind chatter, which is what we are usually listening to, but listening to the raw sounds around you, to pay attention to what I actually am hearing, because we have lost connection with the sense of hearing. We have transformed that into a sense of paying attention to what my own mind is talking. We're listening to our inner chatter, and we have lost connection with basic reality. L is listening to just the sounds in my house and the outside my house. Do that for 5 minutes. Next 5 minutes, you come to the eye, which is immersing. So what are we immersing in? We're immersing in physical sensations. So I watch my body and I just notice the sensations in my fingertips, notice the sensations in my toe tips on my feet.
Uh-huh.
So what's going on in my knees, for instance? And you realize you've forgotten your knees. We don't pay attention to what's going on in the knees ever.
Never.
On my ankles, on my heels, what's going on there? Just bring your mind to these places. And then we come to S, which is seeing. Very simple. So I open my eyes and I look around in my own room, look outside the window, look at the trees, look at the birds. But a beautiful practice is to look at your own hands or to look at the walls in your room and find something that you have never seen before.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll see small marks on the wall, there's a paint which is not correct. The light is reflecting a certain way. If you have pets, you'll see pet hair on the floor. Mm-hmm. You'll see maybe a small ant walking by. If you have ants in the house, you know, in the spring and all that, which happens in some places. So you notice these things just in your surrounding and you're becoming fully grounded in your sensations.
Right.
So breathing, listening, immersing, and seeing. Bliss meditation.
I love that. It's such a powerful way to ground into the present and to just truly be in ourselves and here.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the bliss. And I think that that's such an easy way to remember.
Yeah.
And also to check in with our senses, you know, and you said how I've never talked to my big toe. I've never talked to my ankle or my, you know, there's just so much disconnection.
Yes.
And I can go months without, you know, what is this vessel carrying me? I don't know. And I think that, you know, it's these mindful practices that help us come back. And I'm just so grateful that you're here and you shared that. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Fauna. It was a pleasure talking to you. I'm very happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you. So for all of you guys, I'm sure you want to follow and get more. How can they find you and where are you online?
They can find me by the tag of Finding Awareness on Instagram. And if they want to work with me, can go to findingawareness.com and see what the website has. And one of the things we do is, because healing is such a collective journey, such a collective process, we have a membership where we have a few hundred people doing this work together. We meditate every day, we journal every day, we stay connected to each other, we keep each other accountable, we share our journey, and we meet every single weekend.
Well, you guys got to follow that. And I just wanted to say thank you again for being with us, Amit. This was wonderful. And thank you all for joining us on this episode of Sober Daughter Podcast. Be sure to check back next week. We're going to have another incredible guest sharing their expertise, experiences, and usable tools for us all to heal ourselves and empower ourselves together. So if you want to connect with me further, you can go to @FaunaAsfa on Instagram and all socials. And if you want to ask a question for our next podcast, you can follow @SoberDaughter on Instagram. So please keep coming back. We look forward to having you. Remember, keep doing the good work.